Sorry, what's the next question?
So I was about to ask, what was the first game you developed, the turn when you consider yourself becoming a game designer, then from just a player?
I mean, I would say that the first games that I designed, I want to legitimize the times when I was trying to work out what to do with those little pegs and out how they should fit in the hole. And I think that if anyone's listening to this, and I don't want to gatekeep, like if you're making up a variant on a system, if you're doing a house rule, if you're making a game that you then think, actually, that's terrible, I'm not going to play it, you're still a designer. By the process of thinking about something and then playtesting it, whether with real people or in your mind, and then making some changes to it, that is the process of being a designer. I think that I managed to get something on Board Game Geek in like 2008, I want to say, which was a terrible game. It's a game that you play with a bunch of playing cards. It was either Wee Van Sank or Big Fish, Little Fish. They're both mediocre games that the entire rules are up there. But the first thing that I felt, I'm happy with this, I'm going to progress with it, I'm going to keep going with it, was the game that turned into Yogi. And that came about because London has such a good playtest community. In Glasgow, I had to ask people in a board game club, please, rather than playing a published game, would you mind playing my game? And sometimes they're agreeing to this, but it's a big favor because they really want to play, you know, a nice game, something that's finished, something that's got good art. And if I come along with these little things that are on a cereal box and there's wizards moving around and picking up things from one part of the map and going to the other part of the map, it's like, oh, this is, there's some good ideas here, but it's like a bit of a mess, frankly. And then I came to London, I tried that, and then I tried a few different things, and then eventually I was like, oh, I'm inspired to make this game about people passing around cards and being very unfair and stealing cards from each other. And then in that game, there was one card that said, stand up. If you ever sit down, give this card to someone else. Whoever has this card at the end of the game gets 10 points. And that one card, someone said, oh, you shouldn't have this one card in the game. Either make the game all about doing physical things and silliness, or make the game nothing physical, because it's a bit weird having just one card in there that's like this. And that was very good advice. And they said, they actually gave me permission. They said, well, not that I should need permission, but they said to me, it seems like you want to make a really silly game, and if that's what you want to do, go for it. And so then the next time I remade all of the cards, and then soon they were like challenges like running around a table, hopping, spinning around, doing sit-ups, and then there were things that you started having to do all together, making noises, and then it became more and more physical and simpler until it was literally just draw a card, read it aloud, do what it says. Each turn you get another thing to do, and then you can balance the card on one shoulder, touch your nose, touch your ear, have a card on top of your head, and eventually struggle to draw your new card. And the card might fall off, or you might be like, oh, that's too much for me. And then the last person in the game wins. And that itself was simple enough that it's captured the imagination of, I mean, if five people played each copy of the game, then like millions of people have like enjoyed it. And that's kind of humbling to imagine.
That's a nice thought, yeah.
Yeah, to think how, and still occasionally I get people that did the, bought the self-published version of my game. Like, I think it was 2014, I delivered it in 2015, because it took me a year almost to go from the Kickstarter to actually finishing it and doing all the art and sending it out. I'm really proud of what I did there. And then I, yeah, that was, it's like when you ask a designer, what was your first game? It's never clearly, this is the first game.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But obviously the first published game, the first one that is a major landmark.
Yeah, I guess it's the turn when a lot of people are designers out there, but they don't have the opportunity, or they don't create the circumstances, or because they might not be interested in it, in getting themselves out there. And then you get yourself out there, and then there's the other thing of, how do you monetize that?
Yes.
Which is another aspect.
It's really difficult.
And when you monetize it, then you got the question and the gatekeeping or not of, oh, are you a professional or not? Like in France at the moment, I encoded some games I translated from English and French role-playing games. And they got a great database of role-playing games, and it's created by the public. So I input games I translated from Grant Howitt, like Cloudant. I made a translation of Lasers and Feelings, which was not the first one. And then I translated other games.
Cool.
And so you create a page, if you will, and you send them the information, and they have a look, and they allow it, and maybe they edit it. And I realized that in their website, they got two sections, which is called role-playing games and amateur role-playing games.
Wow.
And I realized, okay, so Honey Heist or Cloudant, which is a one-page RPG with all its merits, it's a professional game. And the game I designed, which is, 100 pages, cards and a box and so on, it's an amateur game. And all the one-page games are amateur. And then I was like, okay, it's your website, so I don't want to get in trouble or anything, but how do you exactly do that? It's like, oh, it's whether or not the people who design it, that's all they do. That's publish the game. And it's like, so yeah, if Grant Howitt releases a game, and I love Grant, that's a professional game. If anyone else releases the exact same game, and it's not their day job, it's an amateur game. And he's like, okay, that's a weird distinction there you put.
That is really weird. That seems incredibly gatekeepy, like not looking at the final art as its own. I guess we get into the question of whether you can separate the art from the artist if you're supporting someone's values by essentially paying them money. But, you know, we're not talking about supporting someone who's transphobic or anything like that. We're just talking about, hey, you work at another job because making games is not your full-time profession. That's really weird to say if you made that game. That feels really weird to me. I could kind of understand the number of copies sold or something like that, but even there, how do you even know that? Most publishers don't release that information.
Yeah, I think it's a cultural thing in the sense they like to put things in boxes.
French people.
The administrative aspect of it. It's very cultural, I think. French people, don't at me. And I see how they got there, which was, okay, we want to separate games which are not completely polished from games which are polished, but then they got the issue of, so that's where they drew the line, which is somewhat simple, although you could still argue about things.
And how do you know what the person is doing? Do you ask them, hey, what do you spend your time doing? Like if Grant Howitt starts working part time as a designer and part time in a restaurant because they decide that cooking is their passion.
Yeah,
does that mean that it's no longer a professional game?
It's a bit fussy. But yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
It's fine. I thought it was weird and interesting. But yeah, there's a question of, oh, you design games, or you share your game, you distribute them, then you publish them, then you monetize them, then you make a living.
When we talk about legitimization of games, for me, having the original version of Yogi, which was called In a Bind at the time, having that be accepted by multiple shops that were regularly buying from me, that felt like, wow, shops are actually ordering that. That's really legitimizing it. And then when a distributor, SDVM at the time, bought, hundreds of copies, it's what, brilliant. They're actually buying that and then they're selling it to shops. It's like through the distribution chain. Obviously, you can get even more professional than that, which is why Yogi is now doing much better because they're an international company. It's much better production values. But a game about wee whimsical creatures and trying to identify them after someone makes noises.
That's okay. A professional game.
See, like, that's the question. Because, like, I made originally 50 copies of that specifically so that it would be low effort. Not so, that's a bad way to put it. So that it would be low anxiety. Because I spent 2 weeks full-time doing all the creatures. It took me like about 6 months of like bits of work here and there to, I feel like it came together quite quickly, putting all the different ideas together. And obviously once you've been doing design for years, like each game that you make has bits of previous games in there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You use, okay, that works in here, that works in there, and it gets faster and faster each time you make it. But I'm at the point where, yeah, for my game, a game about quickly grabbing creatures that are totally different and counting your turnips, that I made 100 copies. I went to Dragon Meat and then I put it on my website, and within a month it had basically sold out, which was brilliant.
Wow.
And then I'm going to make another version with different vegetables and then do that, and then I'm going to do a Kickstarter to see how much demand there is globally. But all of these things, like the compliments game, that's another scary thing. I don't know whether people will buy a game that's about drawing things and then complimenting each other, because that's a bit weird, right?
Yeah,
that's not the thing that you normally do.
You're pushing the brief. That's what's interesting at the same time.
Yeah, I think that there's real joy and value in this experimentation, and that's why, like, sorry if I may ramble about the Bezzy bargain bag, because so what I realized is that by asking someone local to produce these, by doing print on demand, I can produce literally 50 copies and I don't lose money. Now, I know not losing money isn't a great objective. Ideally, I want to make money and pay myself for my time, and but if I do 50 copies, and that's fine. And I can sell them at £5, and that's all it is. And so you can see me at a convention, you can buy some of these games literally for £5. Now, most of my games are like 15, 10, 20 pounds, whatever. But these ones, literally just in a bag, the idea is that someone sees it, it's interesting, well, buy it. It's low risk, it's accessible, you can try it. And for me, I don't feel, oh my gosh, everything needs to be perfect. Because there are so many of those creatures that I think, oh, if only I'd drawn that bit slightly differently. Oh no, this bit of the graphics kind of clipped off. It's not perfect. And if you're looking for issues with it, you will find lots of issues. But those don't really matter to the core of it. It's like 95% as good as it can be, I'm going to say. And like that last 5%, it's going to take maybe like 5 times the time to get there. And it's not worth it. Sometimes it's just worth getting something out there and seeing, do people like it? Yes or no? I was very much inspired by cheap-ass games back in the day who sold things for a pittance. I'm not expecting people to bring all their own stuff, although in the case of drawing creatures, I am going to say you need to have your own pencils or pens and bits of paper. But fundamentally, it's a deck of cards. I can make good games with a deck of cards, and I'm going to try to alternate between games that are maybe something that you might imagine already exists on Board Game Geek, like quickly grabbing things or quickly matching things or drafting things in a new way, and or something that you might think, oh, that's a bit weird, like complimenting creatures or making poetry, a game that's just about words that rhyme, or a game about making noises, or the game with Laura Wood, is which listeners might be particularly interested in, is a two-player LARP where you're sitting around a table, and it came from a discussion with Laura Wood where Laura Wood said, LARPs are great, but the best bit is the argument, when you have an argument with someone else. And so I want to make a game that's just, you abstract away the rest of it. So you spend maybe like 5 minutes doing the setup, which is talking about your character and how they came to be and answering questions. But then you get into the backstory, and then you get to where you are, and then you roleplay the arguments, and then just shout at each other for about 10 minutes.
I don't remember if it's a game for two players or solo. I think it's for two players. There's a game on Itch.io, a role-playing game. Although, the definition are super blurry nowadays, I find. It's called To the Dear Eminent Dr. Crackpot. And the idea is that you're an academic and you write a letter to another academic saying, your theory is nonsense and you're an idiot and these are all the reasons.
Wow.
And then you reply back to that and you have a back and forth of academic level insults.
Two players or are you replying to yourself?
I think it's two players. Okay. Yeah.
That sounds like good fun. I'm not saying that it's the most original thing out there, but I'm not saying that there's no games out there that are about making noises. But what I am saying is that I'm trying to take an idea and run with it, and I am trying to make things accessible. Like with my Kickstarter, I said, this is going to be £1 and you get the print and play. So if you just want the print and play, if you want to do it yourself at home, back it for £1. And I'm going to actually try to make myself an itch.io account this year, and everything, it'll be £1 until the Kickstarter runs, and then it'll go up in price to maybe like £2.50. So it's still fairly cheap. It's not a large amount of money, but when it's like so cheap, it can be like, yeah, anyone who wants it. And also what I love about itch is when you've got community copies,
yeah,
and it's like, yes, you can get this version of it. And like for Kickstarter, you can say, you know what, there's a number of community copies. If someone, not just digital, but I saw someone who made a zine, and then it's like, buy the zine and also sponsor a community copy. And then every time that went up, there was another community copy added. And if someone felt like they had to get a community copy because they weren't able to buy a full thing, they could just get one, no questions asked, and they would be actually sent a physical thing through the post, which is amazing.
Game.
what I like in what you're describing, and I think that and that's why I sympathize with that French website, is that when you try to classify or, you know, gather information, or even ask question in an interview or answer the question in an interview, like, oh, what was your first game? Or like, I just made a submission for the NES, and the question was, when was this game released? And it's like, okay, what are we talking about? So the date I put was the release of the version of the game which I'm submitting, but before that version, which is digital and illustrated, was released, I released a version, just the text. Then after the date I gave them, I released a physical edition. So there's not a single date when it was released. It's an iterative process. Yes. And so much stuff which are being developed right now is really iterative. So there's no... everything you're doing, you're experimenting with games and you're seeing what sticks.
Of course. What
sticks even just with you. And like, then you would go with it or not.
If you look at Rainer Knizia, when they were experimenting with their auctions, and they did every which auction type of game, and then you can see they very much steal from themselves. And then Uwe Rosenberg working on different styles of polyomino games, putting them together, and then they become arguably better and better, and then they sometimes make them streamlined. And for me, like, I would also say within one single project, it might never be finished. Like, you see a game, it has multiple editions, as you've just said. And Serlin, when they make Flash Duel, then they do a second edition. And for me, when I do like the L Deck, which is the multi-game game system, and that's something that I released, I want to say, in 2017, 1st of August. My games all used to be released on that day, but now I celebrate that day in different ways. It had 5 games in the box, but of those 5 games that came in the box, Wibble, which is a speedy word game that we played one round of, that's been slightly changed, that the permanent obligations are now a core feature of the game rather than a variant. And in the old days, I suggested that when you win your 4th card, you reset the round. Whereas now it's when you win your 3rd card, you reset the round, which gives it a better tempo. And then Fable, which is a storytelling game, it used to be 4 cards, and now it's 3 cards just for memory issues, because it actually used to be 5 cards originally, but then people were forgetting them. And then Frazel has actually stayed the same. Alphabetical's been changed because the end game trigger now is when a certain number of cards are removed from the game, rather than when someone gets a certain number of cards in a row, which feels a lot more interactive. Now you need to be aware of what other people are putting out, so it becomes a lot more about the hate drafting, and it becomes a lot more strategic. And yeah, Grabble, so 2 out of the 5 games have stayed the same, 3 of them have changed. And I think this represents my viewpoint that games can keep improving. Between In a Bind, my own release, and Yogi the Gigamic republication, I asked them to change 1.5 cards in terms of the text. And of course, all the art is different. Of course, there's now these PVC cards. It's in a tin. It's new art by someone else. It looks a lot more cartoony. But also, there's a slight modification. And then there might be another slight modification, because I'm looking at the French edition in particular. And I think that there might be a slight issue with one of the cards, because it wasn't quite what I intended because of language barriers. But these things happen even with a big company. Now I understand that Le Pouce dans la Bouche is like a thumb in the mouth, but...
It's like a baby, yeah.
Yeah, but like it was meant to be a finger touching the mouth, which is a bit different.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to have it like touching the mouth so it could be outside. And inside the mouth, especially in times of COVID, it feels very different.
Yeah.
And also, some of the cards, we might want to re-examine what we do at them, because now that we have gone through a pandemic, like maybe I might discuss with them making 1 or 2 very, very slight changes. So a game is never finished. And in the same way, like the L deck, when I made that, I basically committed to making that my life's work. I said, every year there's going to be one brand new game for the deck. I'm going to run these competitions. I'm going to listen to people and see what the games that people make are. I'm going to develop them. But So on the table, I've got the second edition, which is my own graphics. I'm quite happy with the letter shapes and, like, I think that the letters look nice.
It looks classic, you know. With
thank
a big
you very
size.
Much. I'm happy with it. Anyway, my point with the L deck is that going forwards, we're going to have different typefaces, and so I'm also showing one of the future editions, which is actually done by someone else, Miles Atkinson, and all the letters are based around nature. And so in the B, you can see a little mushroom. And I don't know if you...
Yeah, and it's covered with grass and the very woody and pastoral.
And my vision for that is that one day in the future, you'll go into a shop and you'll be like, oh, can I buy that deck with two letters on each card? And it's, oh, you mean the L deck? Yes, here's our display. And then they'll have like the nature-themed one, the one that's about, you know, graffiti-style letters, the classic-looking one, the one that's got all the pictures of biodiversity, different styles. And then also the thing that I realize is that when you're presenting it, going back to what we said about being clear about what type of game it is, when it's five games in a box, or with this one, it's actually six games in a box, and you can see all the games in the back, but there's just one line about each of the games, plus then it says the number of players and the amount of time. And that's not enough space to really describe this is what it's going to make you feel like. Whereas Couple, it's a cooperative game, it's gentle, it's peaceful, it's for two players. And you can get that across with letters that look a bit like nature, yeah, because it kind of suits that. And then you buy it, and then the back of the box, you'll have the entire back of the box to tell you about this one thing. And then another game like Grabble, it'll be like this energetic thing, lots to look at, and it's slightly visually confusing, but don't get too visually confused. And then it'll express itself. And so each box, sure, all of these decks will be able to play all of the different games, which is what I really am proud of, that it's accessible. You can buy one deck and then that unlocks like 50 plus games. But I need to also make it accessible, not just in terms of accessibility of price, but also accessibility of can I actually purchase this, and also accessibility of learning the rules, because it's really interesting to me how Root, which is a complicated game, it's got like five ways to learn the game in the box. It's got the quick start play with the cards, it's got the law of Root, the full instructions, it's got the how to play general guide, it's got the cards that tell you about the other factions, and it's got the instructions on the player board as well. It's got all these different things. And in the same way, I'm going to have like Couple, because I'll have like six cards spare, I want to say. So I'm going to use those six cards in the same way as Fog of Love to kind of say, don't shuffle the deck, just play through these cards and it'll teach you how to play. And I'll have that, I'll have the big thing in the box, I'll have hopefully a video online that's well made, like trying to teach people in as many ways as possible and get them onboarded, because that is the number one difficulty. That is the number one problem, because whereas role-playing games, sometimes they can be very specific. Sure, you might want to play Fiasco loads of times, but how many times am I going to play one particular LARP? It's more probable that I'll choose to play a different one each time I play. Whereas with a board game, they're kind of designed that you keep playing them over and over. Yeah, so yeah, the main issue is getting someone into that first game, they understand the rules. And so how can I make that as easy as possible? And that, not price, is probably the biggest accessibility hurdle.
Yeah, yeah. I like in what you're describing, the concept of your, you got your deck of cards and you use it with different rules, different system. You know, it reminds of the versatility. It's not as popular as it used to be for my parents' generation, even as a kid, I remember. You know, what we call playing cards, which is 52 standard cards, you know, the king, the queen, the ace, and so on.
And there's so many books that you can find hundreds of good quality games, and they're so diverse.
And you got regional games, like where I grew up, Belot was a game, and I've heard there are versions in different countries.
And like in Germany, you can go and play Scat, and of course, Bridge is very much a English-speaking type of thing, I think. thanks to the bridge, there's actually an official bridge community where I can't, the bridge association, and I can't remember what they're called.
Then I met my wife, Persephilia, through poker, because there was a kind of alongside, thanks to or each other supported one another, the release of Casino Royale, the James Bond.
And of course, like quite often nowadays, people think about poker as just being Texas Hold'em, because it's been popularized. But there's so many different variants of poker that feel completely different.
Yeah, and it's interesting how with those 52 cards, which are very standard, and as you say, you go in the shop and say, I just want playing cards. And people don't even ask you, oh, do you want a Marseille Tarot card, or you want the 52, whatever they called, cards, or do you want things called Piacentine, which is another tarot, which is smaller, which is Italian. You got the sticks, the coins, and so on. And people buy those cards, but then you can play money games, which are strictly for adults in a very adult setting. Or you can play games which are... You can play solo games with cards, and there's many different
rules. And you can play GOPS, which is called Game of Pure Strategy, even though it's arguable whether it is. But like even Richard Garfield and Rainer Knizia have made lots of games that can be played using traditional playing cards, myself as well. That's how I got started. Because someone claimed that if for the rest of humanity, all we had was cards with numbers on them, we would still have barely scratched the surface of what is possible. Like, if people were inclined, you could probably make a deck-building game using traditional playing cards, but people don't bother because there's no money in that. And sure, it might be 20% better by having the specific cards that come with Dominion or Eon's End or whatever, but by having something that you can play with these cards, it's instantly familiar, you understand, okay, this is the distribution of these things, and you're able to strategize.
Actually, I just remembered when I was in secondary school towards the end, for a little while what became popular was to play, we call that Bataille Écossaise, Scottish Battle.
Okay.
I hope it's not offensive for
Scots. No, go ahead. Scots, I mean...
well, oh, yeah, you're Scots, actually, so you can yell at me if it's inappropriate. No, but I find it funny because I was talking about the spectrum of the 52 cards, poker, adult, solo game, simple game, family game.
Yeah, like on the bus, we used to play a game that was literally about violence.
Yeah, but so, that's the thing.
Is this the one where the cards, you wrap them on your knuckles?
Yes, exactly. That's what, so it exists elsewhere. So, yeah, depending on what you had... If you had a spade, you would prick the person or something like that.
Yeah, basically, in this game, you want to be not the loser of each round because the loser gets physically punished. It's incredibly barbaric. It's the kind of thing that school children do to each other.
But you consent to that. I mean, hopefully you're not bullied.
But you're kind of... There is a sense of peer pressure.
Yeah. But
I would say, as much as children can... Yeah, I would say... Yeah, sure. It is with consent.
I guess at least you're not getting in a fight.
At least, even if you're doing it because of peer pressure, there's definitely a sense of you are willing to do this. It's not like you're being physically bullied.
Yeah, I could imagine you could be physically bullied through the game, but thankfully that was never the case. At least I never witnessed that. But yeah, again... Yeah, people could take your cards and invent a game like that eventually.
They might, and I might not put that in any of the official books because I don't know if that doesn't feel like something that I want to encourage.
It's like, but okay, B, punch, S, slap.
B, bend over. No, that's wrong. H, headbott. K for kick, L for hit their legs.
All I'm saying, you're going to create the downfall of humanity in violence.
No, in all... Look, I do want this to be created. And playing cards came out just over 500 years ago. And I'm not deluded. I do not think that the L deck is going to ever be as popular as traditional playing cards. But what I would like it to be seen as is, you know, even considered in the same breath as that, to be just, in their own right, a valuable thing that brings value to people. That's what I would like to happen. And I think that this, more than anything, sure, there might be people who enjoy my chaos in Kitty Cataclysm, which is a game about cat puns and chaos and being mean to each other, and then you're... Or, like, yeah, a game about the compliments game. It does feel good. Every time that I play it, I kind of end up feeling slightly happy about that. This house of cards stands precarious.
We played a very short session, and what I find fascinating is, you know, as we were talking about, oh, what's common and not common in entertainment and game violence, intimacy. It's so interesting because you didn't make me uncomfortable, but the concept of the game, it actually, I'd like to play it more, But it's interesting because it actually goes in something which is uncommon, and because it's uncommon, it's slightly uncomfortable.
Yes.
And that's fascinating.
And that's interesting because I don't know if you've become more English by being here for so long, but, you know, as British people, we don't give many compliments. We don't...
Well, I'm not French, but French speakers, like, oh, it's shit. It means, yeah, it's fine. You know, you have charts to translate French to English, which are a bit like that, you know, in a humorous style. But it's kind of truth that the American would be, oh, awesome. The English, like, it's fine. And the French, it's, that's garbage.
Oh, wow. So the French are very cruel.
Yeah, or straightforward, you know, depending on the circumstances.
But the thing is, you can always find things to criticize, but by the same token, you can always find things to be grateful for. And in my day, when I think that it's really important for your mental health to find, especially when we're going through a pandemic, when we're going through political upheaval, to find things to be grateful for. I have the human connection. I played games. I enjoyed eating carrots last night that I made into a stir fry. Long story, but I've never stir fried with carrots before, and they worked out brilliantly as part of this thing. They added a bit of a crunch. And making a list of achievements and things that I enjoyed is really valuable. I could go back and I could think of 5 bad things really quickly. Well, that the stuff I bought was expensive, my hands were cold, my legs were tired, I didn't get as much time as I wanted, that game overran, there wasn't the market at the Royal Festival Hall that I normally really... Why focus on that? It's a question of, if you focus on the positive, you will be a happier person, and I like to believe that asking people to compliment each other, and then go so far as complimenting the compliments... Because by doing that recursion, you listen to the compliments, and then you give the compliments itself value.
That's what I thought was fascinating, is that because you need to compliment the compliment, you need to listen very carefully to someone complimenting you. You cannot be like, I'm barely listening because it's making me uncomfortable, or it's a bit weird to get complimented. No, you need to really listen carefully so you could react to that.
And like, you don't compliment the compliment of the compliment. That would be just silly. Like, I mean, if people want to do that, you know, they can house rule it, take that a step further. But what also interested me was that complimenting a drawing is something that's fairly easy to do, but complimenting the compliment is quite tricky. And I think that that's because as humans, as a society, we are trained to believe that the art, a drawing, can have inherent value. And so it can have qualities that you compliment. But then a compliment itself is just, it's a thing. But a good compliment actually takes skill. A good review, it's like a review, but being positive. I mean, obviously, it's not an impartial review. A review should also include the negatives if you are doing... But I think there's massive value in that complimenting. And yeah, these are the things that I would like to push forward so that people enjoy them. But still, I think that the thing that I believe... In 100 years' time, if any of my games are remembered, I would like it to be for the LDEC game system, for that to continue. Like, each year I'm having this competition, I'm asking people to submit games. I give away £100 to the person who submitted what I consider the best game. And then we do like a live stream now. It started in 2020 because we couldn't play them all in real life. And so I live streamed them. So I was like, oh, actually, let's make that part of the process in 2021, even though I could play it with other people. I live streamed the initial judging, and then I played it privately with other people. And so people get a lot of feedback if they want to listen to that. And then I still get ideas that surprise me, because human ingenuity, people think in different ways. And if people try to be different, they will be different. And with some small things, you'll have some people who are creating new things, some people who are just enjoying them. But yeah, sorry to go on, but that is definitely
us meeting here today. Did anyone submit a role-playing game using DLDEC as the system?
We've had, I think, only one storytelling game. It was... So I made a storytelling game myself. Someone else made a quite involved storytelling game where each of the different suits have a different thing. So like one of them means you need to start a new element. One of them means you need to finish something. One of them means you need to start a new problem in the story. And then it can be done as a solitaire activity. But I've only had one. But it could definitely be a thing that people say, okay, let's put together names from these letters. Let's put together locations. And every so often you come up with different things. I would love to see people taking it to new directions. Not everything has to be a word game. And last year, I think there were 17 submissions. Most of them were word games, but some of them were competitive. Some of them were cooperative. Some of them were games about using the letters and suits to kind of battle each other, and it's nothing to do with words at all. One of them, it's just about matching things, using the alphabet. Okay, you've got to quickly go one higher or one lower than the other letter on the card in the center.
A bit like Rubik's Cube, I imagine.
It's more like Ligretto, if you know that one. It was a speed game.
Okay.
So kind of like Crazy 8, or Uno, but on speed.
Yeah, yeah.
And, we've had quite a few speed games, and I think there's something joyful about just rushing through something that takes 5 minutes, and then you can do that, and then having another game that literally it's a solitaire game that I've seen people playing for 90 minutes, and...
Oh, wow.
It's quite a heavy, in-depth word game.
I would spend easily an additional hour here with you, but I need to go home to have dinner with the family. So I think it's time for homage to another podcast called The Weekly Planet, which is, what are you reading? What are you going to read? It doesn't have to be a book, but the concept is, what is the content you are consuming at the moment or you just finished recently? And what is something you haven't started consuming? Again, it could be a book, a video game, a game that you want to start soon.
I mean, I was thinking like words on paper, but then I started thinking of words on screens, and then you talking about like video games, that blew it right open. Okay, I'm going to give you
What have you enjoyed consuming recently?
Okay, I'm going to give you multiple answers, but I'll go through them quite quickly. TV shows I really enjoyed, Centaur World. This is about a horse that's gone from a war-torn world, and then it goes into this fantasy land. It's full of centaurs.
So is it a game, a book?
It's a TV show, Netflix show. The horse has these adventures about, you need to get different parts of the keys to go back to your world. And then the second season, there's this big bad. And then it's all about the relationships. It's all about getting armies together. And it's a musical. So every show every show is like 22 minutes. They sing like 3-4 songs. And then in the end, it's really emotional because then you learn about the backstory of the big bad. And everyone's, no one's black and white. No one's like the perfect person. There's a lot of silliness. Like there's some birds that are meant to be like Twitter and social media people, and they are just like ridiculous. There's lots of silly jokes, but there's also lots of humanity in there, which I just love.
And it's in a, I remember seeing that passing through, but I have not tried it yet. It's kind of a style similar, a bit like BoJack Horseman, like that.
I would say, unlike BoJack Horseman, I would be willing to watch it with a 12-year-old, but I would want to be there with them to contextualize it.
Yeah.
Because trigger warning, there might be, mourning and... there's bits about social media and consumption, but there might be some slight sexuality in there. There's definitely violence, which is even worse, although, as you say, it's normalized. Books, read Osamu Tezuka. I love that comic artist.
It's amazing.
Phoenix. I've got one of the books of that. Two of them, and I'm reading through one of them just now. That's just such a wonderful book.
Osamu Tezuka, excellent. People will never consume it.
Adolf is one of my favorite comics of all time.
The Three Adolfs, it's a fascinating read. There's so much good stuff. I mean, there's a lot of Astro Boy at my Mighty Atom at my home. I got several statues of the character.
Yeah, and like that's just fun. And like that's the interesting thing about Osamu Tezuka. They're so versatile. Some of the things, like M, which is about ostracization and being different and almost about ridicule, because this disease changes them physically and then everyone's saying, oh no, go away. But then also there is just fun stuff like Astro Boy. There's nothing serious in there. It's just goofy fun, right?
Yeah, and you got I think it's called King Leo, which heavily inspired The Lion King, but on a longer format.
Although, I would argue that The Lion King was basically one of the Shakespearean stories. Well, but anyway,
yeah.
inspiration from something else is never a bad thing. And frankly, being inspired by stuff is, if anything, good. And I would encourage artists to do that shamelessly. Improve and stand on the shoulders of everyone else. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. But as you mentioned with games, and you put your inspiration at the end of the book, people should be, in the Western world, should be much more aware of Tezuka and other great artists like him. My own, what am I reading? I've just finished season 2 of The Witcher, which I enjoyed quite a bit. And we enjoyed it so much that my wife started rewatching season 1. And I'm not sure if it's a storytelling issue or a storytelling quality, but I enjoyed The Witcher, but I told her, I was a bit confused by some plot elements, but I didn't feel like I had to care that much about it because, I don't know, the show comes across a bit as very laid back and, don't worry about that. And I'm like, okay, fine, I'm just enjoying myself. I did not quite follow who was this person and so on. But now rewatching season 1, which was a bit more even confusing, but I don't mean that in a bad way. Personally, I like the time jumps and so on. That I like the fact that it was a bit confusing. Mm. But now rewatching season 1, I'm like, oh my God, okay, so this character and this one, they're all in the first episode already. And they're very important in season 2. Revisiting season 1 after seeing season 2, you're like, oh, I forgot about all of that. And oh, this thing was already foreshadowing all this stuff. It's just...
That sort of Chekhov's gun can be brilliant when something's just lying there and then it really becomes important.
Yeah, but it's funny because I find someone could read that and say, okay, it's bad storytelling because unlike, I don't know, Game of Thrones, it was not obvious enough that you remember it when you watch the second season. But on the other hand, I like the fact that it's more almost subliminal. You're like, I think this rings a bell, but I don't remember where I remember that thing when I'm watching season two. So
yeah, I've not seen that myself, but I've heard great things about The Witcher.
It's fun. I think it doesn't take itself as seriously as Game of Thrones, and I think it's a quality. The cast is great. The lead is a fan of games, so of tabletop games, so that's great. He's a big Warhammer fan, and I think he plays a lot of other games. I mean, it doesn't mean a lot, but it's quite nice. So what are you planning to watch?
I've bought one game this year already.
Oh.
Coma Knots. It's an older game. It's a board game, but with a very much a story elements in it.
Uh-huh.
It's by Jerry Hawthorne. It's meant for, well, 2 to 4. I will either play it with 2 players or maybe play through the first chapter myself to kind of learn the rules first before I explain it to someone else. But I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into that. It's like science fiction. Someone's in a coma. They've got different elements of their psyche. You transport yourselves into their brains, so you're kind of seeing their dreams. And you're trying to raise them from this coma, and you're battling with their inner demons, seems to be the idea behind this game, which is really interesting.
So you would describe it as more board gamey, story gamey, or?
Yeah, it's definitely a board game. But what the designer's done is that you've got a couple of pages to read, and then you've got an actual book, and then you flip over the book, and on a page of the book, there's the board. It's like what they did in Gloomhaven, Jaws of the Lion, where the book becomes the actual board, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, like I played another game like that, which was you played toys from a child.
Do you mean Stuffed Fables?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's from the same company. So that's from Plaid Hat Games, which is the same company. And then they've got Familiar Tales, which is their new thing. But Coma Knots, it passed a lot of people by, which is why I think right now it can be bought from some places for very cheap.
I think the idea of a ring-binded book, so you can open it really flat on the table.
Very clever technology.
Yeah, you could use that in a role-playing game, either with, if it's something with miniatures as a grid. You can buy books like that with just the maps, but I haven't seen a game which would be like a campaign or a setting.
Mm-mm.
And even if it was just a picture, you know, you got your classic, well, those are getting less popular now, but Game Master screen.
Mm-mm-mm.
But if you had a campaign, you say, okay, I'm going back. We were dead yesterday, but now I'm going back to the throne room to visit the queen. And you have the page you would open with the throne room. You would have an image, which is a bit more than an image. You could have, you know, inspiration elements in the picture, like someone hidden and so on. Maybe stickers. I mean, you could. It's got a lot of potential, which would be quite cool to
exploit.
Yeah,
like, I mean, with RPG games, I think that it's different because you want the DMs or GM to have so much more agency.
Yes, of course.
But with a board game, traditionally, it's more controlled by the designers, which is why I think a linear book makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it wouldn't have to be linear. And I had a very good experience playing something very linear, which was the box set for Lone Wolf.
Mm-mm.
And I like this game, which is in between a fantasy fight book and a role-playing game. But and what am I going to read? I'm probably going to watch Mixtape, which is another thing on Netflix. I should be sponsored by Netflix. Which my Pacifilia has been watching, and apparently it's set in the 90s. It's a young girl. She's living with her grandmother. Her parents passed away in a car accident.
Oh,
but
wow.
She finds the back, you know, for people of my age. If you remember music tapes, especially the ones you recorded yourself, she finds the label from the back, you know, the pieces of paper with the list of the tracks which were on the mixtape, and it was a mixtape from her parents, and she thinks it was made for her, and she starts chasing the tracks to recreate the mixtape, but it's 1990 something. You don't have the internet, or you do have it, but it's not quite there. So she's like, oh, the Stooges, this song from the Stooges. Okay, I need to go to my
local. It's like a love letter to music?
Yeah, it's kind of whimsical, and it's like, at some point, there's a song in Japanese on the track list, and she wants to have the translation. So she befriends a neighbor who's Asian. She's from Taiwan. So she's like, I don't know. I don't speak Japanese. I cannot help you. But they still befriend each other. And she's a bit recluse and shy. And through a quest to find the tracks, she engaged with the local community.
That sounds lovely and heartwarming.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I might check it out myself.
Yeah, I need to. Thank you so much, Bez.
It has been a delight. Thank you for having me on the show.
Why did we take so much time to actually have a conversation? I think it's because we engage with one another in game conventions, and we are very busy each time.
Yes, at conventions, it's rare. You can't really... I wouldn't be able to give you so much time at a convention, for sure.
Well, there we go. And hopefully it's now... As I was saying, I often don't know very well my guests. No, I know you much better, and hopefully it's the start of much more interaction. I felt friendship, there I say. Where can people find you when you wish to be found?
Well, I am Stuff by Bez everywhere, so if you go online, stuffbybez.com, if you want, and then that will link you to places like stuffbybez.bigcartel.com is where you can buy my stuff. twitter.com/stuffbybez, that's StuffByBez. instagram.com/stuffbybez, youtube.com/stuffbybez, twitch.tv/stuffbybez, and facebook.com/thingsbybez, because there was a day when Facebook didn't let you have F and B next to each other because they were worried that you might be impersonating them. But yes, check for me everywhere.
I will list everything, absolutely everything, in the description of this episode, and all the games we mentioned and shows we mentioned will be listed there with links that people can click, and if it leads to a purchase in certain platforms, I will get a little fee from that. And you will find also a link to my own game, Paris Gondo, The Life-Saving Magic of Inventoring, which is now shipping worldwide physical copies, and my stock is running low, so don't
congratulations. Don't
wait. Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone. See you next month. And in the meantime,
have good games.
This episode included Game by Monk Turner, New Creature by Outrageous Sherry, House of Cards by Carol Lee, produced by Cornelius Julius, and of course our team song, Sota of Rango by Bandido Roll. The logo of the Rollis podcast is designed by Rollinkans, and you can find it on apparels, face masks, notebooks, stickers, and a bunch of other things alongside other designs on the T Public store of the Rollis podcast. This episode closes our interview with Bez. It was a pleasure meeting her again. I haven't recorded the next episode yet, so I don't know what's going on next month, or rather this month, because my apologies for that, but I was late with the release of this one. Things have been a bit intense with life and work and so on. Also, I ran out, I think I already said so on the show, but I ran out of copies of the box set of Paris Gondo, The Life-Saving Magic of Inventoring, my game, but I just passed the order for brand new cards, which are an important part of those box sets, the dry erase cards, pre-printed and so on. I ordered them from a printer who might be, they should look a bit better than they were in the previous version. And that's thanks to Bez, who she recommended me someone she's used to work with. So I really look forward to receiving the finished product. Today I was starting the process to print more books, and then I will have to pack them all and so on. If you want to see what it looks like, you can check the Instagram account at Rollispod to find out more about that. I've been checking reviews. I don't get a lot of reviews, and at some point I sort of dropped from checking them out. Sadly, the platform I use, or the lack of platform that in my system with the show, makes it so that I don't get notifications when there's a new review. So, and I found one from last summer from There's Trees Up There, who said, "Love it. I'll come back to this every episode. Love the discussions on the industry." So a huge thanks to There's Trees Up There. It means an awful lot to me. And there's one also which was made directly on Podcast Addict a long time ago by Mark Shepherd. Callum makes a pretty sweet podcast. The interviews are always fascinating and go way, way beyond the remit of tabletop role-playing games and geekery. I love to hear all of the interesting things that everyone brings.
the history of fish and chips, for example. I think I was wrong about fish and chips, so maybe double check the nonsense I say. Music and editing is always excellent, and Callum has a lovely accent to boot. It's always great to hear non-anglophone accents. Well, if you want to hear more of my non-anglophone accents, and if you want to hear the English accent of the author of that review, Marx, you can find an interview that Marx recorded with me for his own show. Yes, indeed. And in this interview, Marx asked me a lot of questions about the world list or things happened. It was great to be the one answering the question for once, and I had a lovely time with him. And he asked me a question about Paris Gondo, the life-saving magic of inventorying. So I highly recommend you go check this episode of Yes Indeed. You can also go check an interview I recorded with Paco from GMS Magazine, again about Paris Gondo. And if you don't want to hear about Paris Gondo, but maybe you're a fan of Smallville, there was yet another episode of Smallville Farm to Fable, a Smallville fan cast by Michael Ross from the RPG Academy, in which I was a guest. So, this episode might be late, but if you are following my Twitter account, I definitely pointed at alternatives for you to listen to. On this, that's it. At this point, I hope to go to UK Games Expo. I'm not sure yet if I will. It depends on a number of things. I would love to. But I will have an update about that next month. So see you then, when we'll find out, you and me, who is my guest. And in the meantime, have good games.
Olé, 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 solta o frango e vem com a gente. Olé, 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 solta o frango e vem com a gente.
Nós é tipo bem Jesus, todo mundo a gente ama. Ainda mais se for gatinha, rola até levar pra cama. A gente topa tudo, sapatão e bigodudo na hora do piriri. Cai em mim, outra travesti.
Vai, Batuque!
Olê, 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 solta o frango e vem com a gente. Olê, 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 solta o frango e vem com a gente.
Bon, alors mettons que j'ouvre avec un sirop de 8. Si c'est vous qui avez siroté au tour d'avant, ça tourne dans votre sens. Soit vous laissez filer et vous dites file sirop, soit vous sentez de relancer et vous annoncez un sirop de 14. Vous, comme on a commencé les annonces, vous n'avez pas le droit de laisser filer. Vous pouvez soit relancer avec un sirop de 21, soit vous abandonnez le tour et vous dites couche sirop ou sirop Jeannot, ça dépend des régions. Et après, soit on fait la partie, soit je fais un contre-sirop, boum. Et à partir de là, sirop de pomme sur 21, donc on fait la partie en 4 tours jusqu'à ce qu'il y en ait un qui sirote. À la gagne, il n'y a que 3 possibilités. Soit vous faites votre sirop de 8 et vous dites beau sirop et on recompte. Soit vous faites votre sirop de 14 et vous dites beau sirop, sirop gagnant, et on vous rajoute la moitié. Soit vous faites votre sirop de 21 et vous dites beau sirop, mi-sirop, siroté, gagne sirop, sirop grelot, passe-montagne, sirop bon goût.
Oui, mais moi je crois qu'il faudrait quand même faire un tour pour rien.
Vous avez raison de simplifier.
Même simplifié, j'y arrive pas encore bien à me représenter.
Sinon, moi j'aime bien les règles originales, mais c'est trop compliqué. Les gens, ils ont envie de faire une petite partie pour se détendre. S'il faut passer 3 heures à apprendre les règles...